It's important to state, my mother met my father when she was 15 and he was 22. Her father died when she was 5 and her brothers at the time were at university. So the male influence in her life initially was from my father. And parameters were set early on with an infidelity. Don't make me choose between her or you, Sally, my mum, because I'll choose her. So young sweetheart love was, the parameters were set. And you're talking about a timeline.
So
of,
he was very controlling, you believe, right from the moment that they met, when she was an impressionable teenager.
Totally. And she said to me and my brother separately, I honestly thought I was losing touch with reality, questioning the facts right in front of me. It wasn't until perhaps the 5 years before it happened that we saw something like that happening. And you could see it unravel and he was playing with her. You know, she managed to step away eventually. A lot of people asked why she didn't. She did eventually. But he dangled a post-nuptial agreement at the end, which gave over all the rights to him. And he knew that her world was revolved around him. So she was trapped.
Hi everyone and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard criminal behavioural analyst and author of the Dash Risk Assessment Model and also the author of the book Policing Domestic Violence. And I'm really pleased today to say we have a very special guest who is David Challen. And so David, if you just want to introduce yourself by way of background, that would be great.
Yeah, so I'm David Challen. I'm the youngest son of Sally Challen, who at the moment is serving a murder conviction of my father that happened, it was in 2013. So yeah, and at the moment we're trying to appeal the conviction based on new psychological evidence and also around the idea of coercive control, a law brought in 2015 that we're hoping to create a greater understanding with which to overturn the verdict.
Well, we're really pleased to have you here. And my other two co-hosts, well, one of them is on the other side of the world currently, which is he's travelling elsewhere. So Jim Clementi really wanted to be available to talk to you, but we unfortunately couldn't connect given the time difference. And Lisa Zambetti also really wanted to be on because this is a subject that's important to her. And in fact, she and I discussed your mother's case on episode 113. So for our listeners, if you haven't caught up with Sally Challen's case, please listen to episode 113 first that we recorded to mark International Women's Day. And so, David, just to let our listeners know, so we connected because you listened to the episode, didn't you?
So I had just was opening my eyes up to, you know, coercive control and domestic abuse in the run-up to my mum's appeal. I've really kind of kept this door closed in my life for quite some time. And so in the build-up and in the aftermath, and it was a permission to appeal the sentence, I should say, I was looking into coercive control, trying to understand it. And I found your podcast, started to listen to it and found it really great and informative. It's a great kind of resource, I think, for everyone to kind of pull their thoughts together on, you know, such topics of domestic violence that occur not just here, but around the world.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. It's not just in the UK. We've discussed other cases on Real Crime Profile, including Reva Steenkamp in South Africa and Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman and Molly McLaren, Alice Ruggle. Sadly, there have been too many. And that's really why law change was so important to me and to the other survivors and other services like Women's Aid who supported and spearheaded that law change. And now actually Scotland have just changed the law, bringing in a new offence of coercive control. And so too has Ireland, which is really great news. Hopefully Northern Ireland will be next and then potentially America. So let's just track back and explain what happened in your mother's case, because so some of the history, your mother killed your father in 2010 and she was convicted and sentenced to 22 years originally in 2011, which was then reduced to 18 years on appeal. Now, that's a long sentence in relative terms when you compare it to other sentences of domestic violence murder. And she, as well as killing your father, well, after she attacked him with a hammer, she drove 70 miles to Beachy Head in East Sussex, where she admitted to chaplains trying to coax her away from the cliff edge that she had killed her husband of 31 years. And so she has been serving time in prison for a number of years now. But it was on March the 1st that you won the appeal in the Royal Courts of Justice, where three appeal court judges ruled that Sally could appeal her murder conviction. She also denied the murder, didn't she? And her lawyer put forward her defence of diminished responsibility, which we see in a lot of cases. And yet it doesn't sound like any of the history of what she had been experiencing at the hands of your father had been entered into evidence. And so perhaps, you know, we can dive in of you just explaining to us what it was like growing up at home and what that history looked like.
Yeah, so really living in that home seemed like any other home, really. It was a happy childhood. I'd say mine was the same as most people's. And that's quite an interesting part of coercive control, because it's not out in the open for all to see, which makes it obviously a really hard thing to police or even see, because there's no physical marks and it's not an evident thing to see on the surface. But what I discovered a lot more from the age about 17 upwards, to be honest, was just stories started to come out about how he would just put my mum down, and also the things that I would see. I think at around 17 to 18, I think that was the age where I think he was coming close to 50, and it seemed like he kind of just let go, like the guard and the veil was down. I would say I had a very sort of gut feeling. I think I'm a firm believer in the gut, and I had a gut feeling of something always wrong with my father, nothing could point out, put a finger on. And I think my brother holds the same view. So it was just quite an awkward thing to go through at a younger age. And then when I came of age, and as I said, when he turned near 50, his cavalier approach started to be, I think he bought a Ferrari, he did buy a Ferrari, and he took photos at work with topless models for photo shoots, and then decided to send them out as greetings cards to business partners, potential clients, and also some friends. And I think it's got to some family as well, which is highly embarrassing for my mother. But as well as that, it was just, you know, fat shaming. He was really fat shaming quite, you know, horrifically in front of us, really. He would just say about her weight to friends. For example, if she looked like she lost weight, he would say, you know, she's still got a lot of way, long way to go, or you haven't seen her without her clothes on right in front of us, or even at social parties. I think I attended one when I was younger, and I could see this for myself. And even growing up, he would refer to it as thunder thighs. You know, both me and my brother found it really, truly awkward and horrific to kind of see that. And he would really paint her as a woman that was drunk if she ever kind of questioned him. But it wasn't an equal partnership. It was, you know, he was financially controlling. It was her that had to raise the kids in a certain kind of way, us. I think if we ever kind of held our knives and forks wrong, he would say, why don't you teach these children properly? He just started to become very out of touch near his 50s. And the veil started, like I said, to come down. And you could start to see, you know, my mum really, really, truly loved my father, but he was increasingly making it very difficult for her to survive in a relationship with him. So it was all quite sad, and it's all quite hard to see when you're younger. But I mean, just to make another point, I mean, there was an instance where he was caught going to a brothel, and it was coercive control is a strong, strong thing that happens mentally. It's a strong, domineering mental abuse that happens so subtly from the start, from all the cases I've heard about subsequently from my mother's case. And really, it's just the control, I'm trying to get my head around it a bit. It's really the control, so, of what she's thinking, so of what my mum is thinking. Basically, my dad met my mum. She was 15, he was 21. This is quite an age difference even now. From the very first starter, it was, I think he was cheating, got caught out cheating, and he said, she questioned it about him, and he said, don't make me choose between you or her, because I'll choose her, which is a very firm position to come down on at the start of a relationship. And it's important to note, at that age, my mother's father had died at the age of five. The majority of her brothers, three out of the four, were at a much older age, I'd say about 22, 23 at the age when she's 16. So the real male person in her life was my father from the very start. So it's almost controlling her idea of what a relationship, of what a man does in a relationship, and what is acceptable. And from that moment where she accepted that affair, I would say, or cheating, it was really that set the tone for the rest of the relationship, where it was him building her world that revolved around him. And so she could not exist outside of it. So as I said, when he was getting older, or throughout the relationship, he had been cheating. It did come to a head when he came to near his 50s, and when I was older, when he started to have phone calls from unsolicited numbers. He would make, you know, phone calls to the numbers that are not recognized. And my mother would go through this meticulously, all the phone records and everything, and try figure out the repeated calls that he made. She'd call up the number. She'd find out it's a woman. She'd question him about it. She'd have all the evidence, and he would just sit there and say, you're going mad, Sally. You're making it up. You're going insane. And it was almost a mantra in every argument. I could always hear this. And it was a real mantra that he was putting into her head. It wasn't until he actually caught her going to a brothel. She caught him going to a brothel, that she saw the evidence right there. She had sat outside the brothel, caught him going out of the door from the brothel red-handed, and she had plainest facts, evidence for her eyes to see, chased him all the way home, and he still tried to deflect it. But after that, she said to me in confidence, really, I really thought I was going mad, David. I honestly did. I had all the evidence in my hands of the phone records, and I was starting to believe what he was saying. And none of that was brought up in the court case. And it's startling to look at this case and my mother's life, that is this case, because it's a total campaign of abuse from the age of 16 to the age of 56. And that's no word of sensationalizing. That is actually what it is. And the frightening thing about coercive control is that I suspect there's thousands of cases like this up and down the UK, and perhaps hundreds of thousands more across the world. And it's great that all these countries are starting to recognize coercive control as a law. I think it's really important now that as a watershed moment, this case is to recognize my mother as a victim, because right now she's serving 18 years for murder and is seen as a vengeful housewife when it couldn't be further from the truth.
She has killed my father. No, you can't get around that fact. It's fact. She's serving her time. But we need to judge this sentence properly. And she must be tried justly with the evidence to hand. And we recognise coercive control as of 2015 as a law. And this can only benefit thousands of people.
As you talk, the age difference, the fact that she was so much younger and vulnerable at that age, and in fact 15, you know, obviously you're still a child in the eyes of the law, and him being 21, well, there's a power imbalance straight away. And the things that he was saying to her were about rules that he was setting, and those rules were about constructing a world that only really he existed in. And that's what we see with coercive control. It is a wide-ranging set of behaviours with the end goal of total control over one's partner, Which is why it's quite different from psychological abuse, which is really about hurting a person and gaining compliance on single matters. Coercive control is much more about dominating the person. And as you described, it is highly individualized. So the acts and the behaviors really get to the core of someone's sense of dignity or self-respect. So the things you describe, like the fat shaming, for example, you know, the things that he's hurting her with are the things that matter to her. And it's very insidious, you know, that gaslighting, as you mentioned, that's what we would call it, David, the fact that he was controlling the narrative, even though she clearly saw with her own eyes that he was cheating on her. But yet he still point blank says that it's not what she's seeing. And so he's trying to get her to question her own sanity, which obviously she did in parts and at times.
Yeah, I think it's a real acceptance, really. I think from the first moment that you accept this status quo at a very young age, it really does set the tone for a lot of relationships. I don't think, obviously, all coercive relationships start at a sweetheart young age, but I'm sure a lot of them... Well, a fair amount of them do, because if you don't know what a relationship is or how to act in the norm, it can be very difficult to navigate and see what's real. And another massive factor of coercive control is the isolating of your social circle. And that's no coincidence that these things happen in each case of coercive control that's been looked at or reviewed, because it's really, really controlling that world and not letting an out exterior voice come in and give another idea or version of that world that questions what my father is creating, essentially. I mean, that this was something that came into ours. My brother was dating a long-time girlfriend, Jen, and Jen is a very vocal, independent woman who, you know, obviously, you know, knows right from wrong. And whilst my mother was going through these, you know, problems with my father being controlled, in a sense, I don't think obviously we could diagnose it then, long before, but she was often a support and anchor, and kind of gave my mum at least some confidence to find her voice. My dad did acknowledge and see this. He tried to ban Jen from the house. He tried to dissuades her from being with my brother anymore. You know, don't waste your time with him. He's not going anywhere. And at the same time, he would do that to my brother. He would say, don't waste your time. Don't commit to a relationship. Play the field. He was really trying to break up any support that she had. A cousin of ours, Noel, who was a big stalwart, you know, a big anchor in our family. She's also very vocal and a big support to my mother. And he tried to isolate and discourage her from seeing her, as well as her mother, who didn't live far away, her actual mother. He would really try to point out these people in her life and really take them out of the way of the situation. And as we're talking about kind of the acceptance of the victim with coercive control, from the story I've said so far with the brothel, that came actually to a separation. A lot of people ask, or just say off the bat, reading off this case, well, why would any girl or woman put up with this? And obviously that's a big, big question. And if you look into it, a bit of a naive question, but my mother in this instance did find the encouragement to step away. But having been away from him for about a year, there was an obvious longing and an obvious air. It was basically he was her oxygen. And to not know what he was up to, I think we moved away not far away. It was too close a proximity to the home. And from that point on, once they started talking again, he saw that he had control over her again and started to set the terms out. But this time it was total control. And this time it would be written down in a post-nuptial agreement. And this post-nuptial agreement was crazy. It was crazy. We sent an email to my mother, and the terms were, he said, I will consider your term, I quote, only on these terms. times. You'll continue and complete the divorce only with a £200,000 settlement, far less than the amount that she was legally entitled to. And then we go out together. It means together. This constant talking to strangers is rude and inconsiderate. You'll agree to give up smoking and to give up your constant interruptions when I'm speaking. You know, my mother was, I think, like me, we're really both social people. We love family get-togethers. We love to be social. And she would often strike up a conversation with strangers. And if someone has been isolated so much, it really kind of makes sense that it would happen. But this post-nuptial agreement was really just putting it out there. The divorce solicitor even noted he had never had a client start or stop a proceeding of a divorce in his career as much as her. So you could really see the push and the pull mentally with this case from my mother's life to try get away from him. And really that was the pull towards the end. It was the stress of not knowing how to exist in the world. He was dangling a carrot in front of her face. She knew she shouldn't sign it, but she was going to sign it. And she hoped the problems would go away. And the problems were clearly not going away. And I lived with her up in the last year, and I could see she was unraveling and kind of losing touch mentally in the world. And I felt something was happening, snowballing in a way, that her mind was getting distant, that she wasn't present. It's difficult to talk about because it's you feel partially you knew it was there, but obviously you have to accept that you don't know the full instances of what's going on, and these situations, just no one can foresee them. But when you lay out her life as it has been, this is just a clear-cut case of total coercive control, gaslighting from start to finish, and there's no real support for her at the end, to be honest, because she didn't have that support network.
No, I mean, it sounds like she was incredibly isolated, which, again, those who coercively control want to isolate the victim, and therefore they can totally dominate them. And, you know, the acts that you describe no doubt happened over time with isolation and intimidation and sexual abuse and all these behaviours, the rules that are used to subjugate someone to make them dependent. And, you know, those rules, I think that last bit you described about the post-nup agreement, the terms and conditions that he laid out, I mean, that's just incredible. He actually put that on paper and wanted her to sign it.
Mm. Yeah, it was an actual document that a divorce lawyer looked at, said you should not sign this. She presented it to me and I just said, you're crazy if you sign this. And she started to hide stuff from me because I think I was a big vocal opposite voice to my father. So at a certain stage when the pool was too big, I think I was drowned out. But yes, he wrote this down and he knew what he was doing. He knew he could see her back in the pool of his, I guess, gaze in some kind of way, and she wanted to be there. That's the only way that she could exist.
Right. Well, that's the only thing that she knew, wasn't it? I mean, from the age of 15, he was the only thing that she knew. And like you said, her oxygen. And, you know, the travesty in this is that she really loved him and probably still does love him to some degree. And that's the part people don't understand. It's the emotional investment that those who are involved in these relationships, when you're ground down and you've got your set of morals and ethics and things that you like and things that you don't like, and all of that is eradicated over time by another person, and then you become so dependent on them, the fear sets in of what does it look like not to be with that person. And I would imagine for your mother that was a frightening thought, having been with him for all of her the last part of her childhood and all of her adulthood.
Yeah, I think it's such a sad story, and it's my mum. It's my mum's life, and it feels horrible to know that she's lived her life all in this kind of way, in this mentality. You know, your mother, who's your rock of the family, she did everything for the family. She did my dad's books. She would do put up. pictures of cars up on his website for her because he had a secondhand car sales showroom, and he used to have it online, and she'd have to do that for him. She really did everything, and it was it's sad because really only really up until the last 5 years, I think maybe after the first 2 years actually of remand or first year of remand, she actually took a women's independent course in the prison, and it talked about things of coercive control. Points of control from males in a domestic abuse kind of platform environment. And she came out of it in the visits. I've been in this course. And and they were talking about how, you know, men can control you. And I couldn't believe it. Everything they were saying, it was me. I couldn't believe it. You know, she, you know, talking about how, you know, a man can control you in this way and that way. I honestly couldn't believe it. Everything they were saying, it was like they were saying it was my life. And I just remember at that moment, I looked at my brother, and that was perhaps one of the first moments in my life where I thought, you know, obviously this strong, independent woman, you know, who, you know, looked after us and mothered us and had a control over everything. You know, it seems on the outside like that, but sometimes there's a step in life that some people do miss or is reconstructed by another male, you know, that being my father. And really, she doesn't know what the right and wrongs are in a relationship. And it's so very sad to hear that from her. It kind of was just really horrific. And I think maybe that was even the point when she kind of realized, you know, the sense of independence that was okay and it was normal, and that she wasn't seeing everything through her skewed vision, which she had created.
Right. And it's just terribly sad that she discovered that in prison. And that really shows the importance of healthy relationship education, doesn't it? Age appropriate healthy relationship education, so that young people know what to expect. You know, what is a healthy relationship? What does it look like? So often, David, I'll sit down with women in particular and talk through the Power and Control Wheel, which I don't know if you've seen the Power and Control Wheel from Duluth, Minnesota. And talk about all the range of behaviours that happen. And of course, majority of the time, it's not physical or sexual things that happen, certainly not at the start. It's all the other things of, you know, behaviours of wearing someone down, or it might be even charming them and complimenting them and putting them on a pedestal or showing interest in everything that they do. And then once they have them under the control, then other things start to kick in of, you know, being undermined, or the thing that you prize, whether it's your work, that being criticized, or the very essence of the things that matter to you coming under attack, whether it's your children. But, you know, sometimes it's being gaslit and, you know, you think you know something and something happened a certain way, but yet they say it was something completely different and you feel like you're going mad. And that is so often the case. And I'm hearing from cases all across the world now, and always did before, which is why I felt it's so important that coercive control, that aspect of domestic abuse, is criminalized in its own right, because it is the essence, and it is just so insidious and it's so damaging. Yeah. It's so unhealthy when it happens. And as you describe with your mother, it's this drip, drip, drip effect. Yeah. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens. And so many women do say to me, you know, when I look back, Laura, I don't know how I got to where I was. I don't understand that person I became. But the point is, it can happen to anyone, right? Mm. It's not just a story about your mother. This could be anybody. And I hear so many stories just being at CrimeCon, which was in Nashville. So many people shared their stories with me, you know, in tears, telling me that I had opened up a box that they had shut and compartmentalized it, but now giving it a name made it very real. So I really hope that the legislation, the coercive control law, goes some way in your mother's case, because I think it is really important that it's understood as a form of, in your mother's case, provocation, because of that pressure cooker effect. And the build-up, which is how you described it so eloquently, is that, you know, it was a build-up of things that got to a point where you saw that probably something was going to happen. And sadly, it did.
a difference to the analysis of the facts, which were largely agreed at the trial, and the effect of that behaviour by the perpetrator on her. So whereas she was just seen as mad or jealous in the eyes of the jury, with the assistance or the benefit of the new understanding of coercive and controlling behaviour, those facts can be viewed differently. And the task now, in terms of Sally's case, is to try and persuade the Court of Appeal that the evidence, the fresh evidence we have, would have made a difference if that had been available at the time.
I think the important thing to always state whenever we're talking about this, I think obviously from just a normal audience perspective who don't know about coercive control, I think it's important to say that we're not saying our mum is not, we're not saying that she didn't kill my dad. She did kill my dad. We're not saying that she shouldn't serve any time for that. Not at all. We're asking for her to be recognised as a victim. She is a victim of mental abuse over, all her life, essentially. This is just very important to acknowledge her right to be acknowledged as a victim for everything that she's been through. It's really important. And a lot of people will bat cases like this away. A lot of males will bat this case away by saying, oh, well, that's fine. Be careful what I say if I get some burnt toast from my wife. She might hit me over the head with a hammer. It's really ridiculous. And I think this term coercive control is very, very, very important. I think you mentioned there about how people have a term to latch onto. This is, I think, really, really crucial, because if you take coercive control, the term, out of it, and you say all these little things one by one, they'll say, oh, that sounds like, that sounds like any other relationship. That's it. I think that's the real problem at the moment. And bring in this whole idea this whole movement of Me Too, where we're trying to readjust the thinking of how a relationship is between a man or a woman, how men are treating women. I think it's really important to really cite all these instances now, and that we have a term, coercive control, is fantastic, because we can really back it up and not just say it's just a quirk of the relationship. And my Johnny down the pub always jokes about fat shaming his wife, and he doesn't, sometimes it happens in front of us, and it's just banter. And that's a term that we use in the UK quite a lot, just lad chat or men chat. And it's really a pivotal moment to recognise coercive control. It's really got some momentum now, and I'm really happy about it, because it can only bode well for my mum. As much as I obviously care about this case, my first foresight is as a son, and to see my mother have her independence in her mind through having this independence course and be imprisoned and not be able to be recognized rightfully as a victim, it's important that we strike while the iron is hot. We need to kind of call it out where we say it. I think men have a lot of responsibility. I think these conversations can only usually do happen in female circles, and I think that's a bit of a shame, really. I tweet about it quite a lot, and most of the people who follow or take notice or like it are females. There's men are having a real challenge with masculinity at the moment. It's being redefined under their feet, and it's a lot of struggle. There's a few kickbacks, but cases like this need to be hit home, because if you miss this chance, really, it's a worrying sign for every other case and every other provocation where coercive control is present, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. And, what you talk about in terms of, it's just banter, that kind of casual sexism or putting someone down. Well, with love, you want to lift someone up. It's not about putting them down or subjugating them or using the things that are their vulnerabilities as a way of keeping them down or controlled. And I mean, I know certainly you're talking about the Me Too movement. Well, there's, you know, it's great that you're showing leadership, because I really do think that non-abusive men have to stand with women challenging the behavior. And then you've got some fantastic male role models like Tony Porter. I don't know if you've heard of him, mm-hmm. and the Man Box,
yeah.
and, you know, fantastic leader and leads by example as an activist, and also Jackson Katz, who says that these so-called women's issues are actually men issues. And I tend to play him in training sessions as well to get across that point. And, you know, as you say with coercive control, well, the coercive control law makes a difference in your mother's case and probably in many others due to the effect of his behavior on her. That buildup is highly relevant because that is the pattern. And it allows for a new understanding of coercive control, that the facts in your mother's case can be viewed differently. And I think that's the key part that Harriet Wistridge, who is representing your mother, is going to be looking at in terms of the next steps and working with other experts. So perhaps you can tell us a bit more about what the next steps are in your mother's case.
So the next steps in our mother's case at the moment, I believe it's still with the CPS, which is the Crown Prosecution Service, to look at whether they want to take this case on at a retrial, if they think there's enough in it, which is hopefully not. We're hoping not, because of the time served. You know, obviously the CPS want to win every case they put forward. Otherwise, it's a matter of going to the appeals court again with three judges again, but proving our findings. And the want of the appeals judges is basically to, we put across an idea that coercive control from 2015 is not the same as how we view it now. There's a developed thinking about coercive control, and I think that's fair to say in recent months, up to a year, there's been so many more cases that are getting recognized properly, and that the courts and the policing system don't know how to police or judge these cases. And it's for us to get an expert, a scholar, to look into the research, a better expert than the one we had previously, and get the research done to show that this all correlates, especially with new psychological information, because the psychological information from the trial was only taken in the recent years of her life, which was a great problem in the trial. It's important to acknowledge that in that case, when the trial happened for the first time, her life was only looked at in a short time, which is the last, I think, up to 10 years, which obviously, as we've been speaking about my mum's life and case, it's been, you can't consider it from the last 10 years. It's just silly. It doesn't even look at the case. You're not even getting off the starting blocks. We're looking at my life, her life, and what's happened. But from that point on, we need to, you know, tie those two things together. The more developed thinking around coercive control, which we're getting now, you know, the great, you know, momentum that coercive control is having at the moment means we can get people who want to do the research, because it can be very difficult to find the right people to do the research. So we've got that, new psychological reports, and it's basically a case of when to hear back what they say, whether they want to take the case on or if it goes to appeal, and just hoping for the best. But I think in the meantime, I've trying to be doing as much as I can to kind of raise awareness about this. I know this is all very strange to kind of go through. I think for me and my brother, it's been really, really difficult. We don't really know how to talk about it, and it's a difficult thing to see and acknowledge that your father has done something like this. It is difficult, because at the end of the day, as much as I disliked my father, he obviously is my blood, and if I look in the mirror, I will see characteristics of his face. I can't lose that. But I think it's important that we say the rights and the wrongs, the facts of the case. We're not here to bash him. I'm certainly speaking up on behalf of my brother, because I think it's very hard for us to speak up, and I think someone needs to speak up for our mother. And the more awareness that's created for this kind of case, I think, is amazing, because I've had loads of people reach out to me, and I think it's an amazing thing what we can do with speaking to people around the world and letting them know that, you know, wow, this is me. Someone's waking up on the other side of the world. They're hearing all these things that we're saying coercive control, and they've suddenly put down their coffee cup and gone, oh my God, that's me. And hopefully that kind of is the first step, because we need to really recognize this issue.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I just want to say that we think you're absolutely amazing in speaking up and being an advocate for your mother. You know, it's not an easy job. You're talking about, you know, your own family, and your father's obviously dead, but you really are showing leadership and what it takes to be what I call a real man. And, you know, looking out for your mother's interests and being her voice, because her voice and her power has been taken away from her for so long. So I want to thank you for that. And I know our listeners, you know, will feel exactly the same, because they feel very angry about injustice. And I know that they will want to support you in whatever way possible. And the same as, you know, myself, Jim and Lisa. So is there anything that perhaps our listeners can do to help, or anything that we can do to help?
Well, I think it's really just to be aware. I think it's really difficult for everyone to pick up on coercive control. And I think it's really difficult for people to even reach out. I think with any form of domestic abuse, mental abuse, depression or anything like that, it's always hard for the victim to speak out. I think it's really important that, you know, as friends, we all know something that we've listed here today is happening in someone's relationship. And it's just to maybe ask, you know, and pry, perhaps that your friend is okay in their relationship. And hopefully instances like this don't occur. But, you know, obviously in relation to my mum's case, I think it's important to just to rally around it, you know, be vocal about it, because, you know, I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to speak to, you know, MPs and in our government to raise awareness. I spoke with someone from the opposition party at the moment, who's hopefully going to floor a debate on it, or ask some questions of the people looking after these issues. I think we need to start really rallying around this. And I think it's important that we get as many men involved as possible. You know, we really need to rally around this, not just because it's my mum, but because it's a gross misinjustice. She's portrayed and painted as a vengeful housewife that's killed her husband because he's playing away. But it couldn't be further from the truth. You know, she's been abused all her life. The courts need to recognise it. And it's their moment to recognise domestic abuse and coercive control properly in this country. And it's really going to set the tone for, you know, what's to come, and you know, how policing and how the courts look at these cases in the future. You know, if we drop the ball now, if we say, oh, I'm not going to, you know, if you're in this country listening, you know, if you, you know, if when the appeal date is announced, I would want everyone to come down, because if you just say no, you know, that might be the opportunity missed. You know, I treat every instance where I speak out as hopefully one small tip on the scale, that where that appeals judge walks in, they know a bit more weight is on this hearing that may are making today out of 10 or so, or maybe even 3 or so. But they feel the weight, they know the importance, and they hear or see so many people talking about, maybe see tons of people outside of court, and know they can't get away with this one. They can't be asleep on this one. And, you know, it's really, really to say now, my mother's getting older. You know, she's in her 60s now. It's painful to see her there, watching her whittle away with time. Honestly, it's getting hard to kind of watch it. It's getting very difficult to watch it. But I think it's important that we can kind of give her freedom, because it's a really... She has that feeling. She knows what it is. She's not a threat to society. She's done nothing before this. I want her to have some semblance of a life, you know, where she can lead it independently, not in a relationship that's controlled. I think that's really important.
I think that's important too. And I'm sure our listeners will share with you in that. You know, it's so sad listening to you, you know, talk about her being... The stage of life that she is now, and obviously her liberty and freedom and her chance to spend time with her family abuse-free is really important. And so our listeners, you can reach out to David and show your support. He's on Twitter @David_Challen. We will continue to talk about what's going on with the case. And, you know, it's been a real privilege, David, you joining us from, you're from London and I'm sat in LA to talk about your mother, Sally. And, you know, there's another part to this too, which I know you tweeted today and I tweeted a couple of days ago, was the case of Kate Gutteridge in the UK, which is a case that underpins the nature of serial perpetrators and the need for the register for serial domestic abuse perpetrators and stalkers. And I just want to give some key headlines when we've been talking about coercive control and Sally. Well, this is what Kate said of her former partner. She said that the abuse started with name calling, but soon became physical. And she was left with hundreds of bruises all over her body from punches. He threatened to stab her male friends if they spoke to her, and he would wave knives in her face. He punished her by threatening to stab her or shoot her, and then turned the gun on himself. And he would strangle her, punch her, and turn up at the door in a scream mask to terrify her and her young son. And on one occasion, he locked them all in the house and said that we're all going to die. And he cut the dog's head off. And Kate then thought that was the final straw. She knew that with that act, that it would be her next. And she said this quote, she said, "He made me and my son live every day as if it were going to be our last. If I hadn't contacted the police in time, it could have been a very different outcome for me. It may have been too late." Now, I think that's very true, the way that she describes it. And he was actually sentenced to 16 months for coercive control. But again, it's just not long enough in terms of sentencing. You know, it should be up to 5 years. And in fact, you know, I believe it should be up to 10 years. But we really do need judges to sentence appropriately and understand the context of women being absolutely terrorized and dominated and living their lives in absolute fear. And we really need people to understand that. And of course, the register, I know that you're supporting our calls for it and for people to ensure that they complete the consultation that the government have out UK on the domestic violence bill, because the serial aspect of offending is included in there. And indeed, many of the aspects we've talked about today, people can comment on.
It's so important, this register. I mean, how someone can get in a relationship and not know that the person they get in a relationship has, you know, restraining orders against him from two ex-girlfriends is shocking, and it's just really dropping the ball, to be honest. You know, you're letting someone else become a victim, and it's not right, and it needs to be sorted out. And this whole consultation period that's going on for the domestic violence bill, abuse bill, is really, really so important. You know, it's about just harassing, basically harassing the hell out of our government ministers and the parties on all sides of the house to recognize all these issues properly. Because in this country, you know, it's not going so well. You know, refugees are closing at the moment. On terms of coercive control, I believe it was a refuge, it's a charity shelter for women's aid in this country. Is one in four children think it's okay for coercive control abuse to happen, which is non-physical? They think that's just normal. And I think that's quite a startling statistic. Moving forward, I think it's important to establish an education at school about these signs, because certainly if you look from my mum's perspective at the age of 15, if you're armed with that information, you could identify that information and stay clear of that person. I think really just to hit on all fronts right now is really important.
Absolutely. I mean, Kate's case, as you quite rightly mentioned, it was when it was at court, she was contacted by his two former partners and they talked about the terror. So we really want the duty to be on the police to identify these serial perpetrators and identify them, assess them and manage them in partnership, just as sex offenders are managed. So we're not asking for a separate register. We're asking for the violent and sexual offenders register to be used as a means to identify these individuals, put them on the database and then manage them under the multi-agency public protection arrangements, which already exist. And that, again, just talks to the cultural shift, David, of, you know, taking domestic abuse seriously. You know, the types of behaviours I described in Kate's case and that we've talked about in your mother's case, you know, these are serious acts of abuse and violence that really do entrap and create invisible chains around victims and keep them in fear and terrorised and unable to leave safely. So I think, you know, our listeners will really enjoy this conversation, and I just want to thank you for all that you're doing, and obviously know that you can contact us at any time to do an update, or if you need any help in terms of raising awareness or our listeners to lobby in any way. So is there anything else, David, that you would like to add that we haven't covered?
Not really, to be honest. I think we've covered it all. I think, as I said, I think it's such an important case. I don't think you can really underestimate how important it is, at least in this country. You know, it's a pivotal moment, and I hope when that moment comes, when there is a appeal date set, there will be lots of people there supporting my mother, because it's really supporting an issue that is there for everyone to kind of get a benefit from and never to be abused from properly, and just to be recognized properly as a victim. So when it comes the time, you know, if everyone could be with us, that would be, you know, immensely appreciative.
Absolutely. Sounds good. So for our listeners, if you do tweet about Sally's case, perhaps use the hashtag #FreeSallyChallan. And those when there are any further legal action at the, will it be at the Royal Courts of Justice, David, anything future or somewhere else?
We'll be at the Royal Courts of Justice. Definitely, if anything happens, I'll be tweeting about it. You know, my head's firmly in this, and I'll be doing lots of as much press as I can up before the event. There is going to be, lots of press around it, and I want to get loads of people involved around it, because I think it's a big issue that affects us all. And
absolutely. Well, thank you very much, David. It's been enlightening and a pleasure talking with you. So do keep us updated. We'll follow you on Twitter. And so this is Real Crime Profile signing out. If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.